Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Whole Foods Market brings you meals worth sharing this holiday season. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com/shop for our online menu and ordering system. Local turkeys, inspired sides, and even a little something for your hosts, all available online or in-store at one of our six Manhattan locations. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com for more details.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every week we are here broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, talking about taste. Why? Well, because I think taste matters, and I think a lot of people do too. And today especially, taste matters with our special guest, Carrie Conan, who is calling in from Bonner Springs, Kansas. Are you there, Carrie?
I am. Hi, Mitchell.
Hey, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning.
So Carrie is a collaborator with someone everybody who's listening knows, everybody who's anybody knows, Mark Bittman, who is a great food icon, really, who not only cooks but thinks about food in a particularly interesting and motivating way in his op-ed pieces and also in the New York Times columns and all that sort of stuff. But one of the people who helps inform that incredible food mind is Carrie Conan, who helps you help edit, you help create recipes and edit some of his work and collaborate with him on a variety of projects, don't you?
Mostly the cookbooks, but... Okay. Yes, mostly the cookbooks, but Mark and I have been friends for a long time. Oh, gosh, 20 or so years, and we've been working together about, I don't know, 7 years or so. And so it's a great partnership, and he's a very generous spirit and mind, and it's fun to work with him. So.
I can imagine it. Well, it's fun to read him on the other side, so yeah. I could only be... Well, that's not always true. It's not always fun to work with people. It's fun to read. But and those cookbooks are fantastic. And we are talking today, the day before Thanksgiving, about a topic that really will be at the forefront of many people's minds, and that's the day after Thanksgiving. And we're talking about leftovers, and not just Thanksgiving leftovers, but the whole concept, the whole moral imperative of leftovers. And I think I can think of no better person to speak to about it than you, because I think we are kindred spirits in the waste not, want not.
Definitely.
Right.
I think that once, like, you know, I know that you put things up, and I'm a gardener, and I started putting things up thanks to your expertise, and I think that once you start raising and or at least getting closer to your own food, it's hard to part with it, and we really shouldn't. I feel very strongly that we shouldn't part with it, and unless we absolutely have to.
Right.
What's the oldest thing you've got in your refrigerator right now?
Unfortunately, my partner, Nate, is listening, and I'm not sure that I could say because he'll be all icked out and his friends will make fun of him. But he recently pulled something out of the fridge that was 8 years, had a date 8 years old, actually, that I use still.
Wow.
Yeah, it was in the freezer, in fact, but it was some rendered lard. You know, fat is sort of a preservative, and it keeps
right.
for a long time. And yeah, there are some old things in there. They've
oh,
moved with me. So let's talk about leftovers as a concept, leftovers as a, you know, part of a food movement, and why, you know, in addition to what you've made it and you don't want to sort of waste that energy and that time, why you think it's important for people to understand them and for food people to know what to do with them?
Well, to me, it's really a matter of wasting, and it's also an ultimate convenience food, you know, I mean, that. If you have something already made in the fridge or the pantry or whatever, if you can repurpose that or recycle that into something totally new and different, then it's a very creative process, and it's not to make it too highfalutin, but it's a little artistic in a way, and I take it as a personal challenge.
Right, so you sort of open a fridge and see what's there and see what you can, how you can put the pieces together. So you're not just talking about reheating a piece of roast beef or, you know, takeout Chinese food. You're talking about something else really from a cook's imperative.
Right. I would, reheating it, we can talk about this for a minute because you probably know more about, how the science of this and all works than I do. But it's not going to show the food off in its best form if you just reheat it. And then the question of how to reheat it. Do you throw it in the microwave and essentially steam it, or do you risk, you know, cooking it in a skillet and burning it? Or, you know, it's just not, it just presents more problems than it solves to simply reheat the food, in my mind. And I would much rather take something and turn it into something completely different and unexpected, and make the most out of it in its already prepared or cooked state, rather than to cook it for a second time necessarily. Or if you're going to cook it for a second time, cook it a different way.
Okay. So a lot of people are making a big meal, probably starting today. Some will start tomorrow. Some started 3 weeks ago. And sometimes it's the only meal some people cook is this big Thanksgiving thing. And so is there some way when you're setting out to prepare the first round of food that you actually are thinking about what's going to happen afterwards with what's left? Do you ever approach sort of preparing a meal that way?
Well, I think I definitely do, and I think it's efficient to think of things in batches. If you're going to, for example, take stock, if you're going to go through the trouble of making a chicken or turkey stock for gravy, then I usually make a big, huge pot of it, and before I reduce some of it for the sauce or the gravy, I sock away just the pure stock, unsalted, in the freezer, and then like take half of it or whatever and reduce that rather than reducing the whole, the whole thing. So that's one, I think that's one example.
Mm-hmm.
I know people make, specifically buy larger turkeys just so they have leftovers, and I do that sometimes too, or people might make a ham. As long as you've got the oven going with a big project, make a ham alongside the turkey, that kind of thing.
Right, because you don't want anyone to starve, right?
Right. And in our family, we always had pasta when I was growing up on the Thanksgiving table, and usually it was some kind of baked pasta because that was easier for my mom. So we had a baked ziti or a big lasagna, and so it was a real battle, like what you ate, but there was always a lot of leftovers. So my mom did crazy things with the leftover lasagna or the stuffing.
Tell
we had
me.
We did like stuffing frittata, she would make I would make, when I got into high school, I really loved fried lasagna, and just kind of chop it up and fry it in a hot skillet, almost like hash.
Oh my gosh. No, I don't know that, but that sounds pretty delicious. Right?
Yeah. So just little tweaks like that, so that you're not just, although there's nothing the matter with eating lasagna or stuffing the same.
No,
the
it's
same
also
way
pretty,
the
lasagna
day.
Is pretty good cold out of the fridge, actually, for breakfast.
Well, yeah, sliced like pate.
Right.
Lasagna terrine.
Why do you think some people are so averse to leftovers? Like, I know people who just think they're disgusting in the whole idea of them. And I'm like you, I think it's a challenge. We actually did a giant Thanksgiving like feast on Sunday. It's a tradition in our household. We invite friends, not family, to sort of the dry run for Thanksgiving. And so for the last few days, we've been eating leftovers. And I, too, love to reimagine them. We served another dinner party yesterday, and no one would know that we had eaten those things except that we were proud to have mentioned it. But why do you think some people just, I mean, is it because they had gross ones? Or
I don't know. Maybe we should get someone to call in or someone can email that question, because I've never really been able to relate.
Let me pause for 1 second, remind people, because I didn't do that yet, that you can call in to 718-497-2128 to ask us questions about leftovers or also Thanksgiving cooking questions, since you have an expert on the phone, or you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. All your questions about what to do with your food Friday or what to do staring at a frozen turkey today. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'm curious because it's not something we were just always very, my mom, taught home ec and everything in junior high. And so she ran a very efficient kitchen, and I just don't really remember ever throwing much away. So, she just made it work. So I grew up like that. Maybe it's because, maybe it wasn't that great the first time, or, I don't know, or maybe it just feels like you're revisiting an experience, which is perhaps why I'm not really an advocate of simple reheating.
Right, nor am I. So let's give some people some ideas about what they can do with leftovers, perhaps from Thanksgiving, but also just in general, some creative ideas like lasagna hash. But what are some things that you've done lately with leftovers you've had that you thought worked particularly well, and also, on the other hand, some perhaps that didn't?
Well, I think one of the tricky things is cold pasta. Everybody seems to have it usually sauced, not always sauced, but usually sauced in the fridge. And I'm really, you know, I think the starch in cold pasta, especially Asian noodles like rice noodles, and it's just really unappealing, and rice too for that matter. Cold, and so you have to do, I feel like you have to do something to it, but not too much, because then it turns mushy, which is why, which is why I kind of like the, you know, really high heat in a skillet, like, which just kind of sears it and warms it a little bit and makes it crunchy bits. I really like doing that with pasta. My mom always made pasta frittatas, only she didn't call them frittatas. She added breadcrumbs usually, and I guess what makes them more like a frogia. A little bit denser and more, and a, but still an egg cake, basically. I also like throwing them into soups at the last minute. Sometimes I, this is a, sometimes spaghetti, I snip with scissors and toss like fried rice with rice and make rice-a-roni kind of thing.
Oh, neat. So sort of stir, yeah, like rice-a-roni. That's great. Maybe that was the original San Francisco treat.
But at the very least, you know, you should let the pasta or rice sit out on the counter for a little while if you're going to make a salad out of it, and just let the starches kind of relax and warm up and reabsorb some of the juice, and then I think it's pretty it's pretty good just as a room temperature salad too. If you're worried about it turning too mushy,
right? Or you can sprinkle sort of noodles sometimes on salad as sort of a garnish as opposed to the main thing.
That's good.
So let's look at the frittata a little more closely and tell people what we mean when we say that, because I'm a huge fan of the weekend frittata, which is if we go to someone's house or we're in the country on the weekend and you have little bits of everything, a hamburger and some noodles and some cooked vegetables, I put it all in there and make a beautiful omelet and no one recognizes that we've eaten all that stuff all weekend. So talk a little bit about how you make a frittata, just so the people at home know what we're talking about.
Well, there's a couple of schools of thought. You start with, you know, a skillet, and usually I warm everything, or if you're cooking something from scratch, warm it in a cast iron skillet's great, something that goes from the stove to the oven. And then there's sometimes you can just, if the particulates, for lack of a better term, in the skillet are are sparse and kind of scattered, you can scramble eggs and pour them around it, and you'll get even distribution. But if you have a lot of stuff in the skillet, a lot of vegetables and meat or whatever, or pasta, then you probably want to scramble the eggs and empty the contents of the skillet into the eggs and mix them up a little bit so they don't, so it doesn't stick.
So like in a bowl, so clean up the pan.
Yeah, in
a
bowl with
right.
the eggs. Okay. Yeah. And then make sure there's enough oil to coat the bottom of the pan so it doesn't stick, although I've never really found that to be a problem in well-seasoned cast iron, or you could use nonstick, of course.
And here's my new egg discovery recently, which is that even eggs that have stuck like cement paste to a pan, if you just let the pan sit a couple of minutes, they actually loosen. They come out.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
So by the time you get everybody to the table, and frittatas are great at room temperature too, so there's no reason you can't serve it like that. And so then you pour everything into the pan, and not too high of heat. You want it to not get brown on the bottom. I usually stick a lid on it to help the eggs steam a little bit until they're still wiggly in the center, and then you can put on an extra coating of cheese on top and pop it under the broiler just till the cheese bubbles and the top sets. So the idea is to have still not loose eggs, but nice and custardy and not at all curdled or overcooked, and some kind of little bubbly cheese on top is always nice.
Well, I've just eaten breakfast and my mouth is watering listening to you describe that. Eggs are amazing. Eggs are just sort of a miracle of the kitchen. And in fact, you can just scramble eggs with a bunch of junk in it. You have leftover Chinese food, and scrambled eggs is one of our favorite breakfasts.
Home. That's great. I make Chinese food or Asian food frittatas a lot, and then I don't add the cheese and instead serve it with some kind of soy dipping sauce, dumplings or whatever.
Fritig Fu Young or something.
Yeah.
We are talking with Carrie Conan. The topic is leftovers, but you have an expert of all cooking, home cooking especially, on the phone. Call us with your questions at 718-497-2128 or email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Carrie Conan talking about food.
Music.
Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, and I'm talking to Carrie Conan, who, among many other things, and helps with edit and create Mark Bittman's incredibly successful and wonderful cookbooks, the How to Cook Everything series and others among them. And we're talking about leftovers on the day before Thanksgiving, which I think is funny. While everyone is sort of freaking out about what the day of Thanksgiving is going to be like, we have a longer vision here at Taste Matters, and we're talking about Friday. So there's a question from the studio, in fact. We're here in the shabby chic Roberta's, an incredible place here, a great restaurant. And the question is, how long is too long? Our associate producer, Ashley Koziak, asked, because she and her boyfriend have a debate about this, and he'll eat anything, and she has a much lower tolerance for time. How long is too long, Carrie Conan, to keep something around before you transform it into something else delicious?
Oh, well, you know, I think... I have a similar issue as she does. I don't like things too long, which also maybe it's just it's not like I'm not risky, but I don't I think the quality just diminishes it, and Mark actually has a great line, like, why keep it around that long, you know? I mean, just do something with it. So I would say, you know, for meat, I go 5 days, maybe a week in the fridge after it's fully cooked. Poultry, couple days, 2-3 days. Mm-hmm. Fish, only a day or two. Mm-hmm. And then if, you know, beans and grains, I always have a pot of beans and a pot of grains in the fridge, just plain cooked. And those, a week if they last that long. Mm-hmm. But then whatever, you know, when things start to get to my little mini deadline, then they just go in the freezer.
Right. So the freezer is the ultimate resting place for leftovers. Right?
Right. But you don't want it to be a black hole. I mean, I put everything in labeled containers with a date, at least a month on it. So I know when it was, like restaurant style.
Which is exactly why when Nate pulled something out from 8 years ago, he sort of jumped back from the fridge and was terrified from the freezer.
Yeah, all you need is masking tape and a Sharpie. And you can label it, and it's very helpful. And I think it also encourages you eating more leftovers if you pull it out and you go, oh, yeah, I know what that is, and you don't have to hold it in your hands like a precious object and
right.
spin it around for 5 minutes figuring out what it was.
So this is a related but not exactly leftover topic, and that is little bits of ingredients before they're cooked, some things that you have that often the fridge is full of, half cans of tomato paste chipotles in adobo sauce, or all those things that a recipe will call for a bit and you have to open a thing. And that to me is a whole other category of food that often ends up wasted. When writing recipes, personally, I like to try to use the lowest possible purchase contents and all of it, although obviously too much of something can be a problem. Do you have any thoughts about that, or do you freeze little packages of ingredients that are bits of which are lying around?
I do. It's not my idea in any way, but maybe it's another restaurant or cookbook idea that's been bounced around. But ice cube trays are great for, you know, little bits of tomato paste and stock, of course, and then you just freeze it, pop it out, and put it in a baggie. I'm trying to get more and more into glass containers, which can be a little tricky in the freezer. You can't overfill them, or you have to allow a lot of head space for expansion. But I'm trying to get a little bit away from my reliance on plastic. Just pop them in a container, and then you can take them out one at a time.
Right.
If you don't have an ice tray, you can just put on a small cookie sheet little blobs of things and do your own individually quick frozen IQF
right.
products. And put them on a little piece of parchment or whatever, and once they freeze, you just pop them off and again put them in a little container. So you just have a tablespoon or two here and there of stuff.
Great. What about, is there anything you are proudest of in your memory of using leftovers? I mean, I ask this because I have a couple of things in my mind that, you know, that no one would have ever guessed what was in something. Are there any things in your repertoire in recent past?
Well, Tom, I can't think of one off the top of my head, so share yours and then maybe that will prompt me.
Well, one was not too long ago, I had a bunch of pancake batter left in the fridge, and we had finished the pancakes, you know, a few days before, and I was making a butter cake, and I was like, why not? It's just egg eggs and milk and whatever, and I poured it into the batter for the butter cake. And of course, it was, no one would ever know, you know, and it's all the same things. And so I don't know. I just think,
oh, that's a good one.
I mean, I'm with you that being creative, it's part of the fun. Like if you have all the money in the world and you just decide to throw everything away when you, if you're not going to use it, then there's almost no fun in that. Anyone can make a delicious, you know, roast beef from a fresh, you know, prime rib of meat, but it's to make delicious things from the challenge of what you've got. I think that's the fun, right?
Right. Like for pancake batter, that did trigger something. I've made clafoutis, simple clafoutis,
perfect,
small ones out of
leftover pancake batter.
Where you chop up some fruit or, you know, orange segments or whatever you want, and I use, it's just my husband and I at home, so I use a small gratin baking dish, mm-hmm, and just rub it with butter, layer them in the bottom, and pour the pancake batter on top and bake at about 350 until it's nice and puffed and mm-hmm, and golden. And then
sounds
it's
great,
somewhere between a custard and a spoon bread and a cobbler. And yeah,
right,
it's good.
See, all of these, I think we forget sometimes in America and increasingly around the world that all great food cultures, if we're talking about France or Italy or Japan or whatever, are great food cultures not just because they are discerning and appreciate good food, but because they sort of treat food in an honorific way. Like you said at the beginning, this is about sort of respecting the food we have, whether it's been cooked already or not. And I think that we sometimes forget that it's part of the ethos of a good food culture to think about food at all stages, how it's produced, what waste there is, how it's enjoyed and consumed with friends, that kind of thing. This to me is just a natural piece of the other side of food. I mean, and then all the way to composting and whatever. There's bigger issues here than just what's in the fridge and what's for dinner.
Right. I know. I totally agree. And there's a few things you can do. Like if you know, I think a problem that a lot of people have is they open up the produce bin and they're like, oh my gosh, I forgot about that spinach in there or whatever. I mean, we obviously have to be safe. You know, especially if things have gone south, they've gone south, and you can't just throw them in a blender and you know, pinch your nose. And I would never advocate that.
Unless you're Ruth Reichel's mother, apparently, who would serve poison to friends or something. I know that only from her books. I don't know that firsthand, but yes.
Yeah, no, I mean, people really have gotten, you know, sick doing that kind of thing with the bagged greens and everything. So, I wouldn't advocate that. But once in a while, look in your produce bin and, you know, check on the progress and how fast some things are going south. And, you can intercept them and put them in a suspended state of animation. Like, for instance, I have some really great local Asian greens that I picked up way too early for Thanksgiving dinner. And I checked them this morning, and I'm going to have to blanch them today and, right, and shock them, and they'll be fine. I'll just, you know, dress them in butter tomorrow, and it'll actually save me a step. But if I didn't open the fridge and check on how they were doing,
right,
stick my hand in the thing, you know, tomorrow they would have probably not been as good a quality. So I would, you know, I also kind of advocate that sort of, I know it seems like a pain, but, you know, if you spend time in your fridge anyways, just poke around and kind of see what's going on.
Well, you're leading me to want to change topics almost entirely, and I think it's time to do that. And that is to take a step back and look at the phenomenon or the trends in home cooking. I mean, here in Manhattan, where people have removed kitchens from their apartments and where it's so easy to just pick up things to bring home and stuff, I think we sometimes lose sight about where we are in the world, in America anyway, with home cooking. And you, in not just being in Kansas, but also being sort of integral into the part of this Bittman empire, you contribute to his blog, you write articles on your own for Self. You're sort of immersed in this world of home cooking. And what is your sense about, are people cooking? Do people, I mean, we know we're in a changing food world where more and more people are engaged with food and there's food on TV and all that sort of stuff. But are people going into their fridge and poking around and sort of figuring out what they can do, do you think? I mean, what's your sense about where we are?
Well, I'm not sure they are enough, really. I mean, I think, especially here, I spend a lot of time in New York for work, but I haven't lived there in a while. But it seems like there's a lot of, especially young people, very interested in food and their ingredients. And there's a bit of a real renaissance among, the 20-year-old crowd. And, mm-hmm, and actually that's when I think I probably learned how to cook the most, because that's when you're economically strapped or whatever, and it's cheaper to cook at home than eat out all the time. But here I find, you know, there's kind of two worlds. There's the people who are really into it, and then the people who don't do it at all and rely on convenience food. And there's not much in between, and I'm not sure exactly why that is. We might have skipped a generation, and people, you know, the baby boomers might not know how to cook as well. I don't know. What do you think? What do you see?
Well, I see a little of both. I mean, I see people who are obsessed with food and cooking, who wouldn't normally be. I mean, there are the foodies in the world, but also, like you said, you know, we're in Brooklyn here, which is kind of ground central for the New York City food renaissance, I guess. But then I don't know. Then I see here a lot of people who know a lot about food, but actually don't really know how to make it or engage with it. I mean, they're very sophisticated eaters. But they're always surprised that, you know, you can make a roast chicken, and that roast chicken isn't something that comes in restaurants. And I'm the sort of eater who's like, well, why would I order a roast chicken in a restaurant? I can make a delicious one. I want something that I can't make or that I wouldn't attempt as too much of a production or something like that. So I'm not sure either. You hear from the media that no one's cooking, but then there's all these food magazines, and recipes are the hottest ticket on our blog at jamesbeard.org. So I don't know, honestly, either.
Well, I think I'm lucky that, you know, here in it seems like we wouldn't have access to as much local food because we have such crazy weather. But I'm very lucky to report and happy to report that, you know, I have a great co-op in Lawrence, the community mercantile that we shop at, and they almost exclusively supply, you know, buy from local suppliers, and it's a almost a full size supermarket these days. And I have, you know, I live 4 miles from a winery and 12 miles from one of the best breweries in the country, and you know, so we're very lucky here to have access to local food, and I think that really helps. I mean, I do see that people, you know, they talk about food a lot. When I go to the Y, everybody knows I'm a food writer, and they ask me a lot of questions, and they seem interested, so I find that as a very hopeful sign. So maybe things are getting, you know, maybe it's getting better, and people really do want to eat more health, you know, eat more of their own cooking.
Well, and certainly you and Mark Bittman have been part of that movement. I mean, that book is How to Cook Everything. It's the first crossover cookbook since The Joy of Cooking, I think, that every kitchen has, and everyone, you know, how much they use it, I don't know, but it's certainly on the shelf. And I think that the conceit is that you can actually cook everything, which people don't even know.
I mean, well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say. And if I can get a little plug in, we have apps too.
Oh, sure. What are the apps?
We have the iPad app and the iPhone. It's a universal now for both How to Cook Everything and How to Cook Everything Vegetarian.
And there's more in there than just what's in the book, I imagine.
Actually, it's everything that's in the book in the app completely, and it's offline, so it's always accessible. It's, you know, you don't have to, it's just like carrying the book in your pocket.
Right.
And there's shopping list capabilities, which obviously you can't do from the book, and sharing, you know, social media sharing and things like that. But it's, the material is all there, only it's organized in a less linear way, more modular.
Okay, so great, using the new technology, which I also think has brought people to food. I mean, food apps are so popular on smartphones and on iPads and other readers. I do think, I just want to underline that, you know, in this growing food movement that we're all a part of, I do think that cooking is sometimes a thing that's forgotten a little bit. And I've talked about this with other guests, and I talk about this a lot, that you can know a lot about food and read a lot about it, and you can eat out a lot. But actually, until you cook, and I'd like your input on this, you don't really have a complete understanding. There's that piece is missing, because cooking is a little bit like magic, and when you can do it, it becomes easy, and it sort of gives you a different level of understanding about food. What do you think about that?
I completely agree, but I don't want to make it seem like it's, I mean, I agree it is magic, but it's also not difficult, and the results are all, like Mark likes to say this to the Marks, the results are almost always edible. so, you know, you don't, it's very rare that you eat something that, you know, is simply inedible. So, I mean, that you cook something simply inedible. So I think I want to encourage people to try. And you can start, you know, you can start small, and eventually, you know, if you get familiar enough, then, you know, you'll even be comfortable working with your leftovers, which,
right,
which is kind of, I do see as the final, a little bit of the final frontier.
Fantastic. Well, on that note of the final frontier, I want to thank my guest, Carrie Conan, who is talking to us from Bonner Springs, and who, among other things, is one of the masterminds behind Mark Bittman's How to Cook Everything, wonderful cookbook empire, and contributes to his blog and writes for Self Magazine. You can follow her on Twitter at The Daily Bowl, or at Daily Bowl. And next week, we'll be talking to Melina Shannon DePew. Pietro and David Weber from the Food Truck Association. Malene is actually from the director of food at the Highline. And we'll be talking about new urban street food, a whole new arena of taste. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.